From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2012 Democratic National Convention. I'm Jennifer Ludden. This is the first night of the convention. Democrats are building their case that President Obama deserves a second term. At the podium in Charlotte now is former Ohio Governor Ted Strickland. He's from Ohio, one of the most intense battlegrounds this election, Ted Strickland.
Hiring 1,100 new auto workers in Toledo. Just last month, GM announced a plan to invest $200 million in Lordstown, keeping 5,000 jobs in Ohio and building the next generation of the Chevy Cruze, a car we are proud to say is made entirely in Ohio. And just today, the big three automakers all announced that their auto sales are up by double digits since last year. It's been a long slog back, and we've still got a long way to go. But all over America, all over Ohio, men and women are going back to work with the pride of building something stamped Made in America. Before Barack Obama took office, it looked like that pride could have vanished forever. But today, from the staggering depths of the Great Recession, the nation has had 29 straight months of job growth. Workers across my state and across the country are getting back to work, the dignity of having a good job and a good salary. You know, Vince Lombardi was right when he said, it's not whether you get knocked down, it's whether you get back up. And my friends, Ina Sidney, Brian Schlegel, and James Faison were all knocked down. But Ina, Brian, and James are all standing today. The auto industry is standing today. The middle class is standing today. Ohio is standing today. America is standing strong today. That's what happens. That's what happens when you have a president who stands up for average working people. Barack Obama has stood up for us, and now, by God, we will stand up for him. Quite frankly, Barack Obama knows what it's like to pay a mortgage and student loans. And he knows what it's like to watch a beloved family member in a medical crisis and worry that treatment may be out of reach. Barack Obama knows our struggles, and my friends, he shares our values. Now, Mitt Romney, he lives by a different code. To him, American workers are just numbers on a spreadsheet. To him, all profits are created equal, whether made on our shores or off. That's why companies that Romney invested in were dubbed outsourcing pioneers. Now, you know our nation was built by pioneers, pioneers who accepted untold risks in pursuit of freedom, not by pioneers seeking offshore profits at the expense of American workers here at home. Mitt Romney proudly wrote an op-ed entitled, "Let Detroit go bankrupt." You know, if he had had his way, devastation would have cascaded from Michigan to Ohio and across the nation. Mitt Romney never saw the point of building something when he could profit by tearing it down. If Mitt was Santa Claus, he would fire the reindeer and outsource the elves. Mitt has so little economic patriotism that even his money needs a passport. It's summers on the beaches of the Cayman Islands and winters on the slopes of the Swiss Alps. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 21, the scriptures teach us that where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And my friends, any man who aspires to be our president should keep both his treasure and his heart in the United States of America. And you know, it's well past time for Mitt Romney to come clean with the American people on what he's saying about the president's policy for welfare to work. He's lying. As simple as that. And on his tax returns, he's hiding. You know, you have to wonder just what is so embarrassing that he's going to such great lengths to bury the truth. But whatever he's doing to avoid taxes, can it possibly be worse than the Ryan Romney tax plan that would have sliced Mitt's total tax rate to less than 1%? And so, my friends, there is a true choice in this election. Barack Obama is betting on the American worker. Mitt Romney is betting on a Bermuda shell corporation. Barack Obama saved the American auto industry. Mitt Romney saved on his taxes. Barack Obama is an economic patriot. Mitt Romney is an outsourcing pioneer. My friends, the stakes are too high, the differences too stark to sit this one out. So let us stand as one on November the 6th and move this country forward by re-electing President Barack Obama. Thank you.
And that was former Ohio Governor Ted Strickland with a full-throated attack on Mitt Romney there and an impassioned defense of President Obama. It's being very well received as well. Strickland praised the president's auto bailout, which he says has kept jobs in Ohio, and said that three car manufacturers have seen sales go up double digits. America, he said, is standing strong today. NPR's Sonari Glinton is on the floor at the convention in Charlotte. Hi, Sonari.
Hey, Jennifer. A lot of applause lines about the auto industry. I cover the auto industry, and all three of the American automakers had double-digit growth, but so did the foreign companies that do business in Ohio. I'm standing with Stephen Hightower, and he's a supplier for the automotive industry. Absolutely. How you doing?
Go Very good. Kathleen! How are you, sir?
And what do you think is the most important issue for you coming to this convention?
Well, the number one issue to me is health care and the fact that, you know, Obama cared enough about the American people to do what he had to do to make sure that all people will one day be covered by health care here in the United States.
Now, you told me earlier that you're in John Boehner's congressional district, right?
I am.
And you must hear a lot of criticism of the health care law in your district.
Well, I do, and I hear a lot from small businesses, and it really perplexes me because, you know, it just tells me that people don't really care about their employees if they're willing to opt out and not do what they have to do to help their employees also benefit from the health care laws.
And now you're saying that you thought that health care was going to be a winning issue in Ohio.
The health care will be a winning issue because there's more people in average people than the one percenters in Ohio. I'm a one percenter. However, I'm a one percenter that cares. And there's enough people like me, along with all a multitude of people who really need it, that are going to hospitals, that not really going to the hospital, but almost willing to die because they can't afford the bills and would rather almost die than actually be able to go into debt.
Now sales are up at your business, right?
Sales are doing very well, you know. The automotive industry is doing very well as well. So that's part of the Ohio growth. And, you know, for other people to take advantage of that growth, it's something that Barack Obama did. I mean, it's really a pity to hear the Republicans talk about Ohio's growth under Republican governor when it's really the policies of Barack Obama that actually got us where we're at today.
Well, the auto industry, which is definitely going to be an issue in this coming campaign, I'm going to send it back to you, Jennifer, in Washington.
Sonari Glinton, thank you so much. And let's go to our analyst and chew over that speech by Ted Strickland. E.J. Dionne, he said he had a number of zingers against Mitt Romney. Said he's hiding on his tax returns. He dinged the Ryan's tax plan. He said that even Mitt Romney's money needs a passport, referencing his overseas bank accounts. What did you make of that?
He also said that if Mitt Romney were Santa Claus, he'd fire the reindeer and outsource the elves, which I guess is my favorite line in the speech. That was one tough speech. And I think it's important that it was given by the governor of Ohio, because Ohio, more than any other state, is
former governor of Ohio. We should
former governor, yes, thank you very much. He lost in the last election
to a Republican.
John Kasich, to a Republican governor, John Kasich. Ohio, more than I was talking to some Obama folks last night, Ohio is the one state where white working class voters are really making a difference on Obama's behalf. I think some of it is the auto industry. A lot of the ads against Romney's time with Bain Capital have run in Ohio and have been effective there. But that is the toughest speech we've heard tonight. It may be the toughest speech we hear over the whole convention. And I got to say, this crowd was into it, and they were roaring and jumping. It was a real attack speech. It reminded me that I almost felt I was back in Tampa, where speeches like that were the rule against President Obama.
Matt Continetti, a little red meat here.
It was, and not just a little red meat. I think that Strickland is going to set the pattern for the entire convention. I was most struck when he literally quoted scripture. to rousing applause, whereas if a Republican had quoted scripture at the RNC last week, we would have heard cries about impending theocracy.
I believe he is a Methodist.
Yeah.
I believe he's a Methodist minister.
He is ordained Governor Methodist
Strickland,
minister,
yes. So scripture comes naturally to Ted Strickland.
It seems that the high points thus far tonight have been two guys named Ted. First we had Teddy Kennedy in video, and then we had this siege gun, Ted Strickland. One has to wonder, how did he lose the governorship in 2010? Gives you an idea of just how severe that swing was between 2006 and 8, when the Democrats could do no wrong in electoral politics, and then 2010, where they could do nothing right. And even guys like Ted Strickland lost to people who were usually thought to be slightly out of the mainstream to the right, like John Kasich, on the statewide basis in Ohio. But it was interesting that he was so into this, and he was so far out there rhetorically, he actually used what we would now call the L word of contemporary politics, lying. He said that Mitt Romney was lying in his ads about welfare to work and hiding on his taxes. We don't usually hear that word used. That's a little bit over the usual line.
And I think it's because, at least from my point of view, the Republicans have gone farther in making stuff up in this election than you have heard in a very long time, the welfare ad being a good example of that. And I think you're going to hear the word lying quite a lot during this convention.
Matt Continetti.
And will it work? I mean, the messages we've been hearing from this convention so far, it's only a few hours old, are the same messages we've been hearing all year. And the race continues to be neck and neck. I just don't think these are messages that appeal to the independent voters. They appeal to select groups, such as people who benefited from the auto rescue. There's no question about that. But that's not the entire country.
Well, no, but it is two crucial states, the states of Michigan and Ohio. And just on the independents, a lot of people who now call themselves independents are former Republicans.
Well, and so their votes count, too.
Their
votes count just as much.
No, they're very important, but they are, I think, the margin among the independents for Romney can be pretty good and still not enough. That he can, that, you know, given the split among Republicans and Democrats, I think Romney will carry the independents even if he loses.
Speaking of former Republicans who are now independents, we had Lincoln Chafee speaking a little earlier, the governor of Rhode Island, who changed parties. He is someone who might very well have raised the specter of George Romney, who was a moderate to liberal Republican in his day and stood for a lot of those kinds of ideas in the 1964 Republican convention against Barry Goldwater and at other points in his career. It cost him his career to a large degree, and that might have been brought up and thrown in the face of Mitt Romney. Lincoln Chafee didn't go there. He tends to play the game like a gentleman.
Well, you know, what was interesting is he raised, I thought, a fascinating point about what is the definition of conservative. It was a kind of, in contrast to the Strickland piece, it was actually quite a philosophical speech, and Matt Continetti and I could talk all night about what is a conservative, but we won't burden our listeners with that.
What I will say about the Chafee speech that I thought was interesting is he brought up foreign policy. And, you know, foreign policy is a real strength for President Obama, and I've been surprised it hasn't come up as much as I was expecting to this point. I'm sure it will come up later. But if there's one thing that helped Obama in 08, it was his opposition to the war in Iraq. I think he needs to make a big deal out of it in this convention.
All right. And back at the podium in Charlotte, a familiar face, Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago. He was President Obama's first White House chief of staff.
It's my honor to speak to you about the president I served. I want to tell you what I saw up close while serving our president in a time of crisis, about the values he leans on and the voices he listens to. When President Obama entered the White House, the economy was in a free fall, the auto industry on its back, the banks frozen up. More than 4 million Americans had already lost their jobs. And America's bravest, our men and women in uniform, were fighting for what soon would be the longest war in our history. You remember the uncertainty and the fear that seized our country. On that first day, I said, "Mr. President, which crisis do you want to tackle first?" He looked me in the eye with that look he usually reserved just for his chief of staff. "Rahm, we were sent here to tackle all of them, not choose between them." There was no blueprint or how-to manual for fixing a global financial meltdown, an auto crisis, two wars, and a great recession all at the same time. Believe me, if it existed, I would have found it. Each crisis was so deep and so dangerous. Any one of them would have defined another presidency. We faced a once-in-a-generation moment in American history. And fortunately for all of us, we have a once-in-a-generation president. And in those uncharted waters, I saw where the president finds his North Star. Every night, President Obama reads 10 letters from everyday Americans. When I met with the president at the end of each day, he made sure he had their letters to read at his residence. Letters from people just hoping for someone in power to understand their struggles. I can't tell you how many times, whether we were discussing the economy, health care, or energy prices, the president walked to his desk, take out one of the letters, and read them to us, and say, "This is who we are fighting for. Parents working hard to save for their child's education. Middle-class Americans fighting tooth and nail to hold on to their jobs, their homes, or their life savings." It is their voices that President Obama brings to the Oval Office. It is their values I saw him fight for every day. In the first month in office, he fought for the American Recovery Act to cut taxes for the middle class, to put people to work building America's roads, rails, and runways. And today, our economy has gone from losing 800,000 jobs a month to adding 4.5 million private sector jobs in the last 29 months.
We're listening to Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. This is the Democratic National Convention live coverage from NPR News.
Will taxpayers foot the bill for Wall Street's excesses? In case we forgot, that was the change we believed in. That was the change we fought for. That was the change President Obama delivered. President Obama took office knowing full well that for the last century, presidents had tried to reform our health care system. Today, because of President Obama's courage, kids can stay on their parents' plan until they're 26. Insurers can't kick you off your policy because you have a pre-existing limit, because you've hit the pre-existing limit. They won't be able to deny you because you have a pre-existing condition. Because of President Obama's leadership, every American will have access to affordable, quality health care. That was a change we believed in. That was a change we fought for. That was the change President Obama delivered. I saw the president make the tough calls in the Situation Room. And today, our troops in Iraq have finally come home so America can do some nation building here at home. That was a change we believed in. That was a change we fought for. That was a change President Obama delivered. I remember when the president received the report that the auto industry had a few weeks before its collapse. We met in the Roosevelt Room late into the night. Some of the president's advisors said that in order to save General Motors, you had to let Chrysler go under. Others said it's like throwing good money after bad. Among all the experts, there were only guesses, and nobody put it at better than a 1 in 4 shot. Only the president suggested going all in to save the industry and the jobs. Rising above all the voices in Washington, President Obama listened to the voices that mattered to him most, the voices of the auto workers and the communities that depended on them, just like the voices of the steel workers and the communities on the south side of Chicago where he worked earlier in his career. To President Obama, they weren't just companies that needed a loan. They were communities that needed a leader to stand up for them. And because President Obama made the right choice, over 1 million Americans are still working today. The American auto industry is not just surviving, it's thriving. Where Mitt Romney was willing to turn his back on Akron, Dayton, and Toledo, Ohio, the president said, "I've got your back." That was a change we believed in. That was a change we fought for. That was the change President Obama delivered. And in those first few months, the president worked to put accountability into our children's schools with Race to the Top so that every child has an education that measures up to their full potential. He was willing to demand change and embrace reform. The president never changed his views to suit the moment or the audience, and that is also a measure of leadership. Every challenge was different. Every choice was difficult, but every time, the leadership was steady. Now, the one thing I know with absolute certainty, having served two great presidents, is that in the next 4 years, an unforeseen crisis, challenge, or conflict is going to show up and seize this country. Whose leadership, whose judgment, whose values do you want in the White House when that crisis lands like a thud on the Oval Office desk? A person who said in 4 words, "Let Detroit go bankrupt," or a president who had another 4 words, "Not on my watch." A person who believes in giving tax cuts to the most fortunate, or a president who believes in making college affordable for all Americans. A person who wanted to keep Don't Ask, Don't Tell, or a president who believes that who you love should not keep you from serving the country you love. Believe me, having served two great presidents, when the fog of uncertainty that surrounds a crisis storms into the White House, and all the advisors and chiefs of staff have only guesses and hedges to offer the president, it will be the president's leadership that determines how we as a nation meet the challenges that face the middle class. It is the president's values that shape the future in which the middle class has hope. The person who takes the oath of office in the next 4 months will shape not just the next 4 years, but the next 40 years of this great nation. In these next 4 years, we need proven leadership, proven judgment, and proven values. America needs 4 more years of Barack Obama. Thank you, and God bless you.
And that was Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, former White House Chief of Staff, lauding the steady leadership of his former boss, calling President Obama a once-in-a-generation president, saying he listened to the voices that mattered when he dealt with one crisis after another. Now we are going to hear from a speaker with an unusual background who's also worked in President Obama's White House, and he also stars in the slapstick Hollywood film franchise Harold and Kumar. He is Cal Penn, and here he is in Charlotte.
See, I like that. Thank you very much. I am honored to accept your nomination for President of the United States. Wait. This is not my speech. Prompter guy, can we pull up my speech, please? This is awkward. So while we're waiting, I guess I should have a message, a special message, for those of you at home who recently turned 18. Good news. I can now legally register you to vote. Now, I've worked on a lot of fun movies, but my favorite job was having a boss who gave the order to take out Bin Laden and who's cool with all of us getting gay married. So thank you, invisible man in the chair, for that. And for giving my friends access to affordable health insurance and doubling funding for the Pell Grants. Now, I started volunteering for Barack Obama back in 2007, but nothing really compares to what I saw behind the scenes at the White House when I had the honor to serve for 2 years as President Obama's liaison to young Americans. I saw how hard he fights for us, and one of the most special days was a Saturday in 2012. The Senate had repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, so that anyone can serve the country they love, regardless of whom they love. But the same day, the DREAM Act was blocked. That bill would give immigrant children who've never pledged allegiance to any flag but ours the chance to earn their citizenship. Simple. Important. And I was in a small office on the second floor of the West Wing with about 8 other staffers, and we had worked our hearts out, cared very deeply about what this would mean for other young people. There wasn't a dry eye in the room. Tears of joy for the history that was made, but also tears of sadness because some American dreams would still be deferred. And about 5 minutes later, President Obama walked in, sleeves rolled up, and he said to us, "This is not over. We're going to keep fighting. I'm going to keep fighting. I need young people to keep fighting. That's why we're here." A few months later, President Obama fought to keep taxes from going up on middle-class families. And our Republican friends said, "Sure, you can do that. But one of the things they're willing to trade is a little item called the college tax credit, which today is saving students up to $10,000 over the course of 4 years of school." Now, President Obama paid off his own student loans not too long ago, so he remembers what that's like. And he said that making it easier to go to college and get technical training is exactly how we grow our economy and create jobs and outcompete the entire world. So he stood firm, and that tuition tax credit is still there. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. If we don't register, if we don't vote, it won't be. I volunteered in Iowa in 2007 because, like you, I had friends serving in Iraq. I had friends who were looking for jobs, others who couldn't go to the doctor because they couldn't afford it. I felt that had to change. So I knocked on some doors, I registered voters, and I'm volunteering again because my friend Matt got a job at a Detroit car company that still exists, and Lauren can get the prescriptions that she needs. I'm volunteering because Josiah is back from Iraq. Chris is finishing college on the GI Bill, and 3 weeks ago, my buddy Kevin's boyfriend was able to watch him graduate from Marine Corps training. That's change. And we can't turn back now. So before I close, and as I wonder which Twitter hashtags you'll start using when I'm done talking, hashtag sexyface, I ask all of you young people to join me. You don't even have to put pants on. Go to commit.barackobama.com and register right there. And you know what? The oldies out there, you guys can do it too, okay? Let's keep fighting for a president who has never stopped fighting for us. Go online, find your local campaign office, call your friends, call some strangers, volunteer. That's how we're going to win this thing. Now, I really, really enjoyed listening to Rahm's speech, but he's a mayor now, so he can't use four-letter words. But I'm no mayor, so I've got one for you. Vote. Thank you very much.
And that was Kalpen Modi, known as Kalpen, a comic actor, speaking to young Americans, especially listing changes that President Obama has made, including gay marriage, ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell, saying that is change and urging young people to vote. Next up, the siblings of President and Michelle Obama. Craig Robinson is the First Lady's older brother. He's currently head basketball coach at Oregon State University. And Maya Sotoro Ng is the younger half-sister of the president. She's an assistant professor of education at the University of Hawaii.
Greetings and aloha from the great state of Hawaii. I'm Maya Sotoro Ng, an educator, mother of two, and proud to be Barack Obama's little sister.
I'm Craig Robinson, Michelle Obama's big brother, father of four, and head coach of Oregon State University's men's basketball team. Any seven-footers out there, give me a call.
Craig and I come from different states, we've had different upbringings, and as you can see, we have different perspectives on the world.
But no matter how different we may seem, we share a set of values our parents gave us. Values the same in Chicago as they are in Honolulu. A willingness to work hard, a commitment to education, and the responsibility to look out for each other. They're the values at the core of how Barack and Michelle have lived their lives, raised our nieces, and led this country as President and First Lady of the United States.
4 years ago at this convention, I spoke with you all about how Barack and I didn't grow up with much in the way of wealth, but we were blessed with a mother who taught us that education is the surest path from limited means to limitless opportunity. She inspired me to become a teacher, and she inspired Barack's deep commitment to giving all our young people the opportunities our education gave us. He's made sure more of our youngest children have the stable foundation that Head Start provides. He's saved the jobs of teachers in our schools, and he's helped more of our students afford a higher education. Our mother also taught us that everyone has worth, regardless of who they are or what they believe. That's what inspired Barack's vision for a more inclusive and compassionate America, where everyone has a part to play in our shared story. He's made sure women can fight for equal pay for equal work and stood up for the freedom to make our own decisions about our health. He named two brilliant women who understand our lives to the Supreme Court. And I'll say it again, he ended don't ask, don't tell, so no one would ever have to hide who they love to serve. Making sure everyone in America has a chance to make it like he did, that's what my wonderful big brother is all about, and that's what he'll do for 4 more years.
4 years ago, I told you how, when she was a young girl, Michelle used to talk to me about which kids at school were having a tough time at home and didn't have anybody to stick up for them. And what inspired her most as she traveled this country on that campaign were the stories of brave Americans who juggle everything at home while their husbands and wives are off at war. You see, America's military spouses and families make profound sacrifices too. And Michelle promised that if she had the privilege to serve as First Lady, she'd do everything she could to make sure America was there to honor, recognize, and support their unique service. I've been so proud to watch her rally Americans to give millions of hours of their time and service to our military families. She's working with schools that educate military children to add better courses. When Barack challenged businesses to hire 100,000 veterans and military spouses, Michelle and Jill Biden rallied CEOs to the cause. And last month, they stood with CEOs to announce that they've hired 125,000 veterans and military spouses, surpassing the goal more than a year ahead of schedule. She's still the kind little sister she always was. Now she's just sticking up for those who stand up for us. And I'm proud of her work to give our children a healthier start in life. And let's face it, Maya, I could use the recruits.
Barack and Michelle have always been there for us. Tonight, we are here for them. And with your help, we can fill the White House with their brand of warmth, compassion, and commitment to all our people for 4 more years. Thank you so much.
And that was Maya Sartiro-Ng, the President Barack Obama's sister, saying he makes sure everyone in America has a chance to make it. And we heard from Craig Robinson, Michelle Obama's brother, talking about her work with veterans. Going down to the floor now in Charlotte with NPR's Debbie Elliott.
Hi, I'm here with the Hawaii delegation talking with State Senator Gilbert Kahele. Am I saying that right?
From Kahele Hilo? From Hilo, Hawaii, yeah.
This must be a proud moment for your delegation.
It's
a decision I make.
It's just overwhelming to be here with the governor and our senior senator in Congress, Senator Inouye and Governor Neil Abercrombie. It's just overwhelming to be here and to be a part of this delegation. And we're getting ready for the First Lady of the nation, Michelle Obama, and our native son, Barack Obama. So this is an overwhelming moment for all of us, and we're very proud of our native son and the First Lady who's about to talk to the nation.
Thank you so much for speaking with me, sir.
Thank you very much.
This is our governor.
Hello, Governor.
NPR's Debbie Elliott. If they can't have the convention in Hawaii, you can hang out with the Hawaiian delegation. We're coming up with more coverage from the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. You're listening to live special coverage from NPR News. From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2012 Democratic National Convention. I'm Jennifer Ludden. At the podium now in Charlotte is Lilly Ledbetter. She's the namesake of President Obama's first major piece of legislation, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which resets the statute of limitations for filing equal pay discrimination. Ledbetter is telling her story. She was a supervisor at a Goodyear tire plant in Alabama when she filed suit.
We decided to fight for our family and for your family, too. We sought justice because equal pay for equal work is an American value. That fight took me 10 years. It took me all the way to the Supreme Court. And in a 5-4 decision, they stood on the side of those who shortchanged my pay, my overtime, and my retirement just because I'm a woman. The Supreme Court told me that I should have filed a complaint within 6 months of the company's first decision to pay me less, even though I didn't know about it for nearly 2 decades. And if we hadn't elected President Barack Obama, the Supreme Court's wrong-headed interpretation would have been the law of the land. And that would have been the end of my story. But with President Obama on our side, even though I lost before the Supreme Court, we won. The first bill that President Obama signed into law was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. I think it says something. It says something about his priorities that the first bill he would put his name on has my name on it too. As he said that day with me by his side, making our economy work means making sure it works for everybody. The president signed the bill for his grandmother, whose dreams hit the glass ceiling, and for his daughters, so that theirs never will. Because of his leadership, women who faced pay discrimination like I did now can get their day in court. That was the first step, but it can't be the last, because women still earn just 77 cents for every dollar men make. Those pennies add up to real money. It's real money for the little things like being able to take your kids to the movies, and for the big things like sending them to college. It's paying your rent this month and the mortgage in the future. It's having savings for the bill you didn't expect and savings for the dignified retirement you have earned. Maybe 23 cents doesn't sound like a lot to someone with a Swiss bank account, a Cayman Island investments,
This is Lilly Ledbetter, the namesake in the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, getting a rousing reception in Charlotte.
Worth tens of millions of dollars, but Governor Romney, when we lose 23 cents every hour, every day, every paycheck, every job, over the entire lives, we lose just cannot be measured in dollars. 3 years ago, the House passed the Paycheck Fairness Act to level the playing field for women in America. The Senate Republicans blocked it. Mitt Romney won't even say if he supports it. President Obama does. In the end, I didn't get a dime of money. I was shortchanged. But this fight became bigger than Lilly Ledbetter. Today, it's about my daughter. It's about my granddaughter. It's about women and men. It's about families. It's about equal. It's about equality and justice. This cause, which bears my name, is bigger than me. It's as big as all of you. Which began as my own is now our fight, a fight for the fundamental American values that make our country great. And with President Barack Obama, we're going to win. Thank you very much, and God bless America.
And that was Lilly Ledbetter, a retired tire plant supervisor. She was the namesake for Mr. Obama's first piece of legislation, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, and she just gave a rousing endorsement of the president, saying that the fight for equal pay is bigger than her. We are going to be joined now by Congressman James Clyburn of South Carolina. Welcome to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We're hearing a lot about women's issues tonight, also abortion rights and gay rights. I'm wondering if that risks alienating some more moderate and religious voters like those in your home state.
Well, I don't think so. I happen to be the father of three daughters, and I do believe in my discussions with them. They are very religious, they're church-going, but they do believe that some decisions about their lives ought to be left up to them and their family doctor. We don't know what goes in to the hearts and minds of people when they are faced with such a decision. And I do believe there is something absolutely fundamentally wrong with the government saying to any woman that under any circumstances you cannot make that kind of decision. So I know many, many people in South Carolina who may not profess it very loudly, but they believe that a woman ought to have the right to make those kinds of fundamental decisions about their health.
All right. In 2008, the African-American vote was huge for President Obama. But there's a sense that they may not come out in the same numbers this year, and that could be very crucial in a state where the race is so close, like there in North Carolina. How do you think the campaign can get out the numbers of African-American votes that it needs this time?
Well, I think that vote is going to turn out bigger this time. Last time, African Americans saw a possibility to make history, and they did. This time, things have gotten very personal with African Americans. They are very upset that states like Pennsylvania, Florida, North Carolina tried, but thanks to the governor, vetoed Ohio.
You're talking about restrictions on voting rights.
Absolutely, and people now see that these people will go to any ends in order to suppress the vote and depress voters, and they are taking it personally. I can tell you that. I've been traveling around this country, and I'm telling you, African Americans and other minorities are taking this campaign very personally.
Hmm. I'm wondering what message you want swing voters to take away from this convention as compared to what they saw last week with the Republicans.
Well, I think that the swing voters are very high on the possibilities for our great country. What they saw last week down in Tampa was, I'll call it, Dr. Gloom and Mr. Doom. That's all we got from them, gloom and doom. The fact of the matter is, I agree with Paul Ryan that we have come to that proverbial fork in the road. The question is, are we going to take the high road or the low road? The high road that will continue us on this path to prosperity for 29 consecutive months now. We've had job growth in the private sector. We now have families being able to make decisions about their futures, about their health. We got young people who now can afford college that could not afford it before. They are going to be very, very incentivized. And so I do believe that independent voters are going to be making their decisions based upon their own personal futures, their own personal conditions, and they're not going to worry whether it's Democrat or Republican. They're going to go on the side of what's best for their futures.
Congressman James Clyburn, the only Democratic congressman from South Carolina, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And our next speaker tonight, Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. He is at the podium now in Charlotte. He's that state's first black governor and only the second black governor in the country, Deval Patrick.
Well, we believe in an economy that grows opportunity out to the middle class and the disenfranchised, not just up to the well-connected. We believe that freedom means keeping government out of our most private affairs, including out of a woman's decision whether to keep an unwanted pregnancy and everybody's decision about whom to marry. We believe that we owe the next generation a better country than we found, and that every American has a stake in that. We believe that in times like these, we should turn to each other, not on each other. And we believe that government has a role to play, not in solving every problem in everybody's life, but in helping people help themselves to the American dream. That's what Democrats believe. That's what Americans believe. And if we want to win elections in November and keep our country moving forward, if we want to earn the privilege to lead, my message is this. It's time for Democrats to grow a backbone and stand up for what we believe. Quit waiting. Quit waiting for pundits or polls or super PACs to tell us who the next president or senator or congressman is going to be. We're Americans. We shape our own future. And let's all start by standing up for President Barack Obama. This is the president. This is the president who delivered the security of affordable health care to every single American in every corner of this country after 90 years of trying. This is the president who brought Osama bin Laden to justice, who ended the war in Iraq and is ending the war in Afghanistan. This is the president who ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell, so that love of country, not love of another, determines fitness for service, who made equal pay for equal work the law of the land. This is the president who saved the American auto industry from extinction, the American financial industry from self-destruction, the American economy from full-blown depression, who added 4.5 million private sector jobs in the last 2.5 years, more than in George Bush's 8 years in office. My friends, the list of accomplishments is long, impressive, and barely told. And even more impressive when you consider that congressional Republicans have made obstruction itself the centerpiece of their governing strategy. With a record like that and a vision that hopeful and powerful, I, for one, will not stand by and let him be bullied out of office, and neither should you. I want you to be clear. What's at stake is real. It's real. The Orchard Gardens Elementary School in Boston was in trouble. Its record was poor, its spirit was broken, and its reputation was a wreck. No matter how bad things were in other urban schools in the city, people would say, well, at least we're not Orchard Gardens. Today, thanks to a host of new tools, many enacted with the help of the Obama administration, Orchard Gardens is turning itself around. Teaching standards and accountabilities are higher. The school day is longer and filled with experiential learning, art, exercise, and music. The head of pediatric psychology from a local hospital comes to consult with faculty and parents on the toughest personal issues in students' home lives. Attendance is up, thanks to a mentoring initiative. In less than a year, Orchard Gardens went from one of the worst schools in the district to one of the best in the state. The whole school community is engaged and proud. So am I. At the end of my visit, about a year and a half ago, the first grade, led by a veteran teacher, gathered to recite Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. And when I started to applaud, the teacher said, "Not yet, Governor." Then she began to ask those six and seven-year-olds questions. What, she asked, does creed mean? What does nullification mean? Where is Stone Mountain? And as the hands of those 6 and 7 year olds shot up, I realized that she had taught the children not just to memorize that speech, but to understand it. See, today's Republicans Today's Republicans and their nominee for president tell us that those first graders are on their own to deal with their poverty, with ill-prepared young parents, maybe who speak English as a second language, with an underfunded school, with neighborhood crime and blight, with no access to nutritious food and no place for their mom to cash a paycheck, with a job market that needs skills they don't have, with no way to pay for college. But those Orchard Gardens kids should not be left on their own. Those children are America's children too, yours and mine. And among them are the future scientists and entrepreneurs, teachers, artists, engineers, laborers, and civic leaders we desperately need. For this country to rise, they must rise. And they and their cause must have a champion in the White House. That champion is Barack Obama. That cause is the American dream. Let's fight for that. Let's canvass and phone bank and get out the vote for that. Let's go tell everyone we meet that when the American dream is on the line, we want Barack Obama in charge. Thank you so much. God bless you, and God bless the United States.
And that was Deval Patrick, Massachusetts governor, the nation's second black governor since Reconstruction. He rallied the crowd there in Charlotte, saying it's time for Democrats to grow a backbone and stand up for what we believe, and saying don't let us stand by and let Barack Obama be bullied out of office. NPR Sonari Glinton is standing down there on their floor of the convention. How did that go over with the Massachusetts delegation, Sonari?
Well, it went over extremely well. It's been a very emotional day here. For the Massachusetts delegation, especially with the film. I'm standing with the film of the late Ted Kennedy. I'm with Sam Schusterman, who's a delegate, and she's in law school. But tell me what your friends are thinking about this election.
Well, I tell you, my friends are very motivated about this election, and I think we're very surprised at some of the issues we're talking about around the table. I'm 29 years old, and 10 years ago, I couldn't imagine we'd be talking about whether insurance companies would be covering birth control prescriptions and whether or not there's such a thing as legitimate rape. I think that young people are standing up. We want to be part of a country we're proud of, and we know the President of the United States has our back, and we're out there talking to each other, registering each other to vote, working on our campuses and off our campuses in the neighborhoods to get people to the polls in November, because there's so much at stake in this election.
Well, Massachusetts, young voters in Massachusetts, at least, seem
and
motivated.
And Sonari Glinton, we're going to have to leave it right there. Yep. Thank you so much. We'll check in with you again. Coming up in the next hour, Michelle Obama will speak. This is special coverage of the 2012 Democratic National Convention from NPR News.